seem to even attempt to comment on them. As they say, you must see it to believe it. The flight to Cambodia was another 7 hours, and I began to grasp what a feat traveling around the world really was. In the end, we would fly 36,000 miles and spend nearly 3 full days in the air. I wasn't sure what to expect when I reached Cambodia. Though I'd traveled to Hong Kong and Korea for track competitions, I wasn't prepared for the city of Phnom Penh when we landed. In a strange way, the land struck me as being both hopeful and tragic. The main thoroughfare bustled like cities around the world, but instead of cars, people drove scooters. Beyond the tenement housing were shiny new high-rises. For every man in a business suit, I saw another who'd lost a leg from the landmines that still dot the countryside. Everywhere I looked, I saw the contradiction of the country. A country struggling to put its past behind it in order to secure a more prosperous future. Our stop in Phnom Penh was a short one. We would go to the National Museum and the Royal Palace before going straight back to the airport for a flight to Angkor. The National Museum, I thought, was also representative of Cambodia. Outside the gates were numerous beggars pleading with tourists for pocket change. Inside were other reminders of the war that had raged for decades. Though the museum was filled with collectibles and statues of various Indian gods, Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma, there was no glass in any of the windows. Everything inside was thus exposed to the elements. The windows had been destroyed in the war a quarter of a century earlier, and there was no money to replace them. Few, if any, of the items on display were bolted down. Instead, objects had simply been set on pedestals. Most of the statues were broken, and bullet holes dotted the crumbling plaster walls. The ceiling was lined with watermarks, and stains ran down the walls. The floor was bare concrete. Yet the guides spoke with pride in their voices about the museum, the culture, and the spirit of their people. And by the time we left, both my brother and I were subdued. Of all the places we'd been up to that point, Cambodia seemed the most foreign and incomprehensible, and we both felt out of place. We then toured the Royal Palace, which is actually a series of roughly 20 buildings and temples inside a walled compound the size of a city block. One building is the palace itself, where the king lives. Another building is the Welcome Hall, a magnificent structure with high painted ceilings, long red carpet, and soaring columns, where dignitaries are brought when they want an audience with the king. In a nearby temple, still on the palace grounds, we saw the giant silver Buddha. Unlike many of the cultural artifacts, it hadn't been destroyed in the war, and it seemed to occupy a central place in the heart of Cambodians, surrounded as it was by hundreds of small offerings of flowers. Our stop in Phnom Penh was less than 3 hours, though it seemed far longer. With the weight of the past bearing down on us, we set off for the jungles of Angkor, where we would arrive just after sundown. The main road from the Angkor airport also leads to the temples and massive hotels sprouted amid what was once jungle. The splendor of some of these establishments was dizzying. In any country in the world, they would be regarded as 5-star hotels. Gleaming structures were surrounded by lavishly designed and softly lit landscaping. Towering palms and lush ferns bordered winding entry roads. Flowers sprouted everywhere the eye could see. Half a dozen hotels boasted rooms that cost more than the average Cambodian earned in a year. Some had health and beauty spas, and all had upscale restaurants that required jackets. All this, while on the road out front, people rode bicycles or scooters. At our hotel, we were informed that an excursion to Angkor Wat was planned at sunrise. Most people, including Micah, opted out. It was the first and only time on the entire trip that Micah and I weren't together to see a sight. And aside from only a few moments here and there, it was the first time we hadn't been together in nearly 2 weeks. On the bus ride over, I was asked by one of the members of our tour group how we were getting along. "Fine," I said. "Mike is easy to travel with." "Doesn't it bother you? I mean that you're with him all the time?" I thought about it, finally realizing how odd it must have seemed. "Actually, it doesn't. We always seem to want to do the same thing. I guess we're just in sync." "That's amazing," he said, shaking his head. "You guys get along better than most husbands and wives. If you watch closely, you can tell that some couples are already starting to get a little tired of each other." I was anxious to see Angkor Wat. The structure itself, square with a towering temple mountain in the center, 3 concentric quadrangular enclosures, and surrounding walls approximately 275 yards in length, all surrounded by a giant moat, is reached by a long causeway, and we made our way toward the outer walls. Just beyond them, our guide told us to stop. In the darkness, we could see nothing at all. In time, the sky behind the temple began glowing red, then fanned out in vivid orange, then finally yellow. Against the changing sky, the temple was outlined by shadows, the features invisible. Yet I couldn't look away. Even from a distance, and despite reading about it, the size of Angkor Wat nonetheless gave me pause. Had it been built recently, it would be considered massive. When it was built 800 years ago, it must have defied comprehension. We stayed long enough to watch the sky turn from yellow to blue, and then climbed back onto the bus. As we drove, the countryside of Angkor began springing to life. The roads became crowded with scooters, zipping nimbly around the lumbering bus. There seemed to be no driving regulations. People drove on either side, wove in and out of traffic, and veered at the last second, but somehow it seemed to work. The scooter riders were, in their own way, as impressive as Angkor Wat. We learned that most of the scooters had been manufactured in China and cost around $600. No bigger than a moped, they were Cambodia's version of a Chevy Suburban. "There's four people on that scooter," one person said, and everyone on the bus would pile toward the window to see it. "Over here, there's five," another would shout, and we'd all move to the windows on the other side of the bus. "I see six. No way. Back there, look." We did. I blinked at the sight of a scooter with six people on it. It was moving slowly, but moving nonetheless, veering like everyone else. "You're not going to believe this," someone finally said. "Up ahead of us, take a look." "What?" He pointed. "I count seven on that one." And there were. A man was seated in the middle. On the scooter were what seemed to be his kids. Two little girls were seated behind the father. Three more little kids were in front of him. And riding on his shoulders was his son, the youngest of the bunch, a child who looked to be about five. All were dressed in uniforms. It seemed obvious that Dad was bringing the kids to school. While we continued on toward the hotel, everyone on the bus looked unsuccessfully for a scooter carrying eight people, as if in this remarkable environment, seven weren't enough. Because of the heat and humidity in Cambodia, our day was divided into two segments. In the morning, we'd visit the other temples and sites, Thap Prom, the Bayon, and the Elephant Terrace. After lunch, we'd spend a few hours at the hotel. Later in the afternoon, we'd visit Angkor Wat. Our first stop was Thap Prom, and despite the grandiosity of Angkor Wat, it would be our favorite temple to visit. It wasn't large and lay pretty much in ruins, but the jungle growth intrigued us. Shrouded in shade, the giant roots of strangler figs and silk cotton wove around doorways and crept over walls as if the roots had been poured from the trunk. It seemed as if the jungle was in the act of devouring the temple, as it at once swallowed all the others. The roots were unstoppable. Though the giant ones caught our attention first, closer inspection revealed the finer roots forcing their way between blocks. In time, the block would eventually be loosened. In a couple of decades, those blocks would be found on the ground with the countless others that were piled around us. The temple, though in a terrible state of disrepair, had somehow maintained its original shape. Like all of the temples we would see, it had four concentric square walls, actually tunnels, surrounding a temple mountain, and we gradually wove our way through the ruins toward the center. Unlike so many of the sites we'd visited, as soon as we rounded the corner, it was easy to lose sight of the others in our group. "This is great," Micah said. "It's amazing, isn't it? It reminds me of the Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom ride at Disneyland." "You're such a crass American," I complained. "Don't you think it does? Or it could be a movie set, like someone had imagined what a ruined temple looked like, then built it. It looks too real to be real." "Too real to be real?" "Exactly," he nodded. "Like someone planned it." 40 minutes later, we were back on the bus. Our next stop was the Bayon. There the jungle had been cut back and we made our way through the ruins. Unlike the heat in Australia, the heat in Angkor was intensified by the humidity. Mosquitoes were prevalent, and we slathered on the bug spray. The Bayon was unremarkable when compared to Thap Prom. It had the same configuration as the others, though we did see our first examples of the relief carvings for which the temples are famous. In the sandstone, we could make out various images, each of which came with a story. The stories, however, were hard to follow, Of all the languages in the countries we visited, Cambodian seemed most foreign. The linguistic sounds were so different that simple words were incomprehensible. Thus, whenever the guide spoke even in English, we had to sit through heavy accents and long pauses as our Cambodian guide stumbled over words. It was not only hard for us to understand what they were saying, but they had an equally difficult time understanding us. "Why do they call them relief carvings instead of just carvings?" Micah asked. "These relief carvings," our guide answered with an accommodating smile. "But why relief?" "See," he said, pointing to the wall. "Relief carvings." He enunciated the word carefully. "Relief." "Ah," Micah said, knowing he wasn't getting through. "Thanks anyway." The guide bowed. "I'm welcome." The sun was directly overhead and beating down hard when we finally arrived at the Elephant Terrace. We were told the rulers used to sit atop the wall, essentially a long, thick wall with elephants carved on it, to watch performances on the plaza out front. "What kind of performances?" Micah asked.
"Like the, play?"
"No,
the, circus?" Micah offered.
"Yes, the circus, with the swingers on the,
The guide waved his hand, mimicking the word he was looking for.
"Trapeze?"
"Yes, trapeze, and there were women,
The guide moved a little, swinging his hips to the side.
"Dancers?"
"Yes, dancers, and,
Elephants?" Micah suggested.
"No, no elephants."
The 3-hour break, once we were back at the hotel, was welcome. Both Micah and I worked out, ate and napped before heading off to Angkor Wat. By then, we'd been told repeatedly that our 2 hours there wouldn't be nearly long enough to fully appreciate it. In a way, we learned, they were right, simply because of its size and scope. And yet, unless you were well-versed in the stories about the Hindu god Vishnu and had the patience to learn how those stories had been interpreted into pictures, 2 hours was more than enough. One of the TCS lecturers on the trip was absolutely fascinated by, and had studied intensively, the relief carvings of Angkor Wat. After making our way over the causeway to the main wall surrounding the temple, he grew giddy with excitement. As we stared and photographed portions of the carvings, and they were amazingly detailed, I have to admit, our lecturer would stop every few steps and point to the various sections of the wall, describing it in even further detail, his voice resounding with enthusiasm. To be honest, it only confused us.
"Now this," he might say, "is where Vishnu crosses the river. Look where he's standing. See the temple in the foreground?"
We'd squint, searching for the temple and finding it, thinking, so far, so good. Then, unfortunately, the lecturer would go on. "As you probably know, the temple behind him represents the cosmos as centered on Mount Meru. In other words, it's the model of the universe in microcosm. This, as with everything about Angkor Wat, is the same representation. And all these reliefs come from the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, as well as the Bhagavad Gita, which is absolutely extraordinary if you think about it. Furthermore, as we move along, you'll also notice scenes from the life of Suryavarman II himself, who apparently decided to identify himself with Rama and Krishna, the incarnations of Vishnu, thus making himself out to be a Devaraja. You can just imagine what Jayavarman II thought about that, especially after defeating the Chams. Oh, and just up ahead we'll see the famous relief that depicts the myth of cosmic renewal, also known as the churning of the sea of milk." By then, Micah's eyes had acquired a familiar glassy sheen. "Milk?" That's what he said. "What is that supposed to mean?" Micah went on. "And who's Rama? And what on earth is Devaraja? Do you want me to ask?" "No," he said quickly. "Maybe if no one asks, he'll eventually move on." Micah paused for a moment before shaking his head. "I mean, does he really think we know all this stuff about Shiva?" "Vishnu, he's talking to us about the god Vishnu." "Whatever," he said.
My point is, I don't know any of this. I won't remember any of this. It's too much. I mean, the wall is 10 feet high and goes all the way around the temple. It's over half a mile long. Architecturally, it's amazing, and I can see why it took decades to build it. But unless you live for this stuff, the carvings seem to run together.
Relief carvings, I said.
Relief. Whatever. Meanwhile, our lecturer was still talking on and on, growing even more excited.
And notice outside the four sandstone heads atop the perimeter wall. Can you see them? We think those represent the guardians of the four directions, or maybe even the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara.
When we reached the center of Angkor Wat and stood at the base of the Temple Mount, the lecturer was in full swing. It's interesting to compare Mahayana and Theravada Buddhism. But for historical purposes, you might keep in mind the animism that was also prevalent in the early Khmer Empire. For example, the belief in Nikta. Perhaps you noticed the serpent god Naga near the entrance. This...
Excuse me, Micah interrupted.
The lecturer paused.
Yes?
Micah pointed to the Temple Mountain.
Can we climb that thing?
We spent the remaining hour exploring the ruins on our own. We climbed the steep, crumbling steps and wandered through the rocky corridors, posed for pictures, and surveyed Angkor Wat from the highest spots we could reach.
I hope there's not a test on any of this, Micah said as we walked back down the causeway.
I'd flunk.
You and me both.
He paused. Do you realize we've been gone for 2 weeks?
It doesn't seem like it.
It's kind of sad to think about it. I've been dreaming about this trip for months, and we're already more than halfway through.
It's going so fast.
Dreams are funny like that, I said. You want something so desperately you somehow get it, then just as suddenly it's over. Like running races. All that training for a couple of minutes on the track. The secret, I've learned, is to appreciate the process.
Are you getting philosophical on me?
No, I admitted. I'm just talking to hear my head rattle.
Good, he said.
I've had more than enough philosophy for one day. We walked a little farther.
Do you miss Christine, I asked.
Yeah, he said.
The kids, too.
How about you?
I nodded.
I've been missing them since I left.
Kat and I married in Manchester, New Hampshire, Kathy's hometown. In the previous 6 months, she'd had to make the arrangements from across the country. She'd gone home only twice. My bride-to-be, I was beginning to understand, was quite efficient when she needed to be. We were married on July 22, 1989. In the Catholic Church she'd grown up attending, and as she was led to the aisle by her father, I couldn't look away. Her eyes were luminous beneath her veil, and her hands were shaking slightly when I took them in my own. I barely remember the ceremony. The only moment that stands out in my mind was when I slipped the ring on her finger. The reception was also a blur, and we were both exhausted by the time we arrived in Hawaii for our honeymoon. The honeymoon had been a gift from Billy and Pat Mills, who had come to love Kathy as much as I did. Lisa, who'd long since found someone new in her life, jokingly began referring to me as the ex-boyfriend that never went away. Because the ceremony and reception had been held on the other side of the country, only a few of my friends had been able to make it. My mom, however, decided to throw a party in Sacramento in our honor. She decorated the backyard, made a cake, set out beer and food, and everyone I knew from childhood stopped by to congratulate us. The party went on for hours, and in some ways was more fun than the original reception. I had returned from honeymooning in Maui, owned 2 rental properties with Micah, and had finished my second, albeit unpublished, novel. I was excited about a new business I was starting and was deeply in love with my new wife. It was, I still think, one of the best evenings and summers I'd ever spent. If possible, my mom was even more excited than we were. In the course of the evening, she'd mentioned that she was thinking about quitting her job. Now that we were out of college and with Dad earning more than he ever had, there was no reason for her to keep heading into the office every day. She'd worked long enough, she said, and she wanted to spend her time enjoying the family and riding horses with my dad. In fact, she said, her eyes shining with excitement, we're going riding again next weekend. On the following Friday night, only 6 weeks after we'd been married, Kathy and I went to a barbecue at my parents' house. We were the only kids there. Micah was in Cancun, he'd be arriving back home on Saturday, and Dana was in Los Angeles with her boyfriend. It was a quiet evening. We cooked and ate dinner. Afterward, we settled in the living room to watch a movie. When the hour grew late, I mentioned that Kathy and I should head on home, and kissed my mom on the cheek as she sat in her chair. Maybe we'll drop by tomorrow night, I said. Okay, she said. We'd love to have you. Drive safe, you two. Bye, Mom, I waved. By noon, my mom and dad were riding horses on the trails that run alongside the American River. Like most August days in the Sacramento Valley, the temperature hovered in the 90s and the air was still. Only a few clouds dotted the horizon, and my mom and dad shared a picnic lunch in one of the many shady areas that lined the parkway. A little while later, they were riding again. Because of the heat, however, the horses neither trotted nor galloped. Instead, my parents rode them at a slow walk, taking in the scenery between bits of conversation. As the river rounded a bend, the trail narrowed and my father led Napoleon into the front, Chinook and my mom close behind. According to my dad, nothing extraordinary happened next. There were no sudden noises, no snakes, nothing to startle either horse at all. The gravel pathway was strewn with rocks, he noted. At times there was a slight angle to it, but again, nothing that either horse should have had trouble navigating at all. Indeed, both horses, and thousands of other horses over the years, had passed over that same stretch of trail dozens of times. Yet that day, for whatever reason, Chinook stumbled. I was in the kitchen of my apartment as the phone rang. When I answered, my father sounded breathless, on the verge of hyperventilating. "Your mom's been in an accident," he started. "She fell off the horse. They took her to UC Davis Medical Center. Is she okay?" "I don't know. I don't know," his voice simultaneously panicked and robotic. "I had to bring the horses back. I haven't talked to the doctor. I've got to get down there. I'm on my way." Kathy and I drove to the hospital terrified and trying to convince ourselves that it wasn't serious. As soon as we rushed into the emergency room, we asked the nurse in charge what was going on. After checking her notes and heading back to talk to someone, she rejoined us. "Your mother's in surgery," she said. "They think she ruptured her spleen, and her arm might be broken." I sighed with relief. I knew that though the injuries were serious, they weren't necessarily life-threatening. A moment later, Mike Marat, an old friend from high school who was on the cross-country team with me, hurried through the door. "What are you doing here?" I asked. "I was running on the trail when I saw a group of people and recognized your dad. I helped him get the horses back and came straight to the hospital from there. What's happening with your mom?" Mike, like all my friends, loved my mom and seemed as frightened as I was. "I don't know," I said. "They said she ruptured her spleen, but no one's come out to talk to me." "You were there, though. Was it serious? How was she?" "She wasn't conscious," he said. "That's all I know. The helicopter got there just a couple of minutes after I did." The world seemed to be whirling in slow motion. "Is there anything you need me to do? Can I call anyone?" "Yeah," I said. I gave him the phone numbers of relatives on both my mom's and dad's sides. "Tell them what happened and tell them to call everyone else." He jotted down the numbers. "And find Micah," I said. "He's supposed to be flying in from Cancun this afternoon. He's coming into San Francisco." "What airline?" "I don't know." "What time is he coming in?" "I don't know. Do what you can. And find Dana, too. She's in Los Angeles with Mike Lee." Mike nodded. "Okay," he said. "I'll take care of it." My dad arrived a few minutes later, pale and shaking. I told him what I knew, and he burst into tears. I held him as he cried, and a moment later he was mumbling, "I'm okay now, I'm okay," trying to stop the tears. We took a seat, and minutes passed without a word. 10, 20. I tried to look through a magazine, but couldn't concentrate on the words. Kathy sat beside me, her hand on my leg. Then she moved closer to my father. He sat and rose and paced, then sat again. He rose and paced, then sat again. By then, 40 minutes had gone by, and no one knew what was going on. Micah had just stepped off the plane when he heard his name being paged over the public address system at San Francisco International Airport, requesting him to answer the courtesy phone. "Please go directly to UC Davis Medical Center," the voice on the other end told him. "What's going on?" "That's all the message says." Suddenly panicked, he jumped into a limousine no cabs were available to take him to a friend's house where he'd left his car for the week. He was 2 hours from Sacramento. After an hour, a soft-spoken man wearing a suit came out to greet us. "Mr. Sparks?" We all rose, wondering if he was the doctor. He said that he wasn't. "I work with the hospital as a counselor," he said. "I know this is hard, but please come with me." We followed him into a small waiting room. We were the only family in the room. It seemed it had been set aside for us. It was oppressive. I felt my chest constrict even before he said the words. "Your wife has suffered a cerebral hemorrhage," he said to my father. His voice was gentle and ached with obvious sympathy. Tears welled again in my father's eyes. "Is she going to be okay?" my dad whispered. His voice began growing softer. I could hear the plea contained within it. "Please, please, tell me she's going to be okay." "I'm sorry," the man said, "but it doesn't look good." The room began to spin. All I could do was stare at him. "She's not going to die, is she?" I croaked out. "I'm so sorry," he said again. And though he stayed with us, I don't remember him saying anything else. All I remember is suddenly reaching for Kathy and my dad. I drew them tight against me, crying as I'd never cried before. Dana had gotten the call. She was boarding the next plane to Sacramento. I called a couple of relatives and told them what was happening. One by one, I heard them burst into tears and promise to be there as fast as they could. Minutes crawled by as if they were inhabiting a time warp. The three of us broke down and tried to recover again and again. An hour passed before we were able to see my mom. When we went into the room to see her, oxygen was being administered and she was receiving fluids. I could hear the heart machine beeping steadily. For just a moment, it looked as if she were sleeping. And despite the fact that my mind knew what was happening, I nonetheless grasped at hope, praying for a miracle. Later that evening, her face began to swell. The fluids were necessary to keep her organs from being damaged in the event we would donate them, and little by little, she looked less like my mom. Some of the relatives had arrived, and others were on the way. All had been in and out of the room, but no one could stay very long. It was unbearable to be with my mom because it wasn't her. My mom had always been so full of life, but it seemed wrong to stand in the hallway. Each of us drifted back and forth, trying to figure out which alternative was less terrible. More relatives arrived. The hallway began to crowd with friends as well. People looked to each other for support. I didn't want to believe what was happening. No one wanted to believe it. Kathy never left my side and held my hand throughout it all, but I felt myself constantly being pulled back to my mother. When no one was in the room, I entered and closed the door behind me. All at once, my eyes welled with tears. I reached for her hand and felt the warmth I always had. I kissed the back of her hand. My voice was ragged, and though I'd already cried for most of the afternoon, I simply couldn't stop when I was with her. Despite the swelling, she looked beautiful, and I wanted with all my heart and soul, and more than I've ever wanted anything, simply for her to open her eyes. "Please, Mama," I whispered through my tears. "Please. If you're going to come out of this, you've got to do it soon, okay? You're running out of time. Please try, okay? Just squeeze my hand. We all need you." I lowered my head to her chest, crying hard, feeling something inside me begin to die as well. Micah arrived, and as soon as I saw him, I burst into tears in his arms. Dana arrived an hour after Micah did, and had to be supported as she moved down the hallway toward us. She was wailing. Hers were the tears of someone not only losing a mother, but her best friend as well. In time, my brother and I led her into the room. We'd warned her about the swelling, but my sister broke down again as soon as she saw how bad it had become. My mother looked unreal, a stranger to our eyes. "It doesn't look like Mom," she whispered. Micah held her tight. "Look at her hands, Dana," he whispered. "Just look at her hands. Those haven't changed. You can still see Mom right there." "Oh, Mama," she cried. "Oh, Mama, please come back." But she couldn't respond to our pleas. My mom, who had sacrificed so much in her life, who had loved her children more than any mother could, whose organs would go on to save the lives of three people, died on September 4th, 1989. She was 47 years old. Chapter 13, Phnom Penh, Cambodia, February 6th. After 2 days in Angkor, we flew back to Phnom Penh, this time for a tour of the Holocaust Museum and a trip to the killing fields. The museum is located in downtown Phnom Penh, which had been seized by the Khmer Rouge in 1975. Pol Pot, the leader of the Khmer Rouge, hoped to create a perfect communist state and evacuated the entire city. 1 million people were forced into the countryside. With the exception of Khmer Rouge soldiers, whose average age was 12, Phnom Penh became largely a ghost town. With the departure of U.S. forces from Vietnam and no other country willing to intervene, Pol Pot began his bloody reign. His first act was to invite all the educated populace back into the city, upon which he promptly executed them. Torture became a way of life and death for thousands. In time, to save the cost of bullets, most of the executions were carried out by striking the victim on the back of the head with thick bamboo poles. Over the next few years, more than 1 million people were killed, either through enforced hardship or executions in what are now known as the killing fields. On the flight, Mike and I anticipated our arrival with a degree of ambivalence. Though we wanted to see both the museum and the killing fields, our excitement was tempered by our apprehension. This, unlike so many of the sites, wasn't part of ancient history. It was modern history, home to events that people want to forget, despite knowing that they never should. From the outside, the Holocaust Museum looked unremarkable, a two-story balconied building set off the main road. It resembled the high school it had originally been. But belying its innocuous appearance was the sinister barbed wire that still encircled it. This was the place where Pol Pot tortured his victims. Our guide, we learned, had attended school there, and it felt disconcerting, almost surreal, when he pointed to his former classroom before moving us to the exhibits. They were a series of horrors, a room where they used electricity to torture victims. Other rooms featured equally horrific devices. The rooms hadn't been altered since Phnom Penh had been reclaimed, and on the floors and walls, bloodstains were still visible. So much that we saw that day seemed beyond belief. The fact that most of the Khmer Rouge were children was almost too appalling to contemplate. We were told that Khmer Rouge soldiers dispatched their victims without remorse and with businesslike efficiency. Children killing mothers and fathers and other children by striking them on the back of the head. My oldest son was roughly the same age as the soldiers, which made me sick to my stomach. On the walls were pictures of the victims. Some pictures showed prisoners being tortured. Others showed the bodies unearthed in the killing fields. In either corner of the main room, there were two small temples that housed the skulls of those victims who'd been discovered in the camp after the guards had fled. On the wall was a painting of a young boy in a soldier's uniform, striking and killing a victim in the killing fields. The artist, we learned, had lost his family there. No one on the tour could think of anything to say. Instead, we moved from site to site, shaking our heads and muttering under our breath. Awful, evil, sad, sickening. More than one member of the tour had to leave. The intensity was overwhelming. "Did you lose anyone in your family?" I finally asked the guard. When he answered, he spoke steadily, as if he'd been asked the question 1,000 times and could answer by rote. At the same time, he couldn't hide a quality of what seemed almost stunned disbelief at his own words. "Yes, I lost almost all of them. My wife, my father, my mother, my grandparents, all my aunts and uncles." "Did you have any siblings?" "Yes," he said. "A younger brother." "Is he still alive?" "I don't know," he said. "I haven't seen him since the war. He was a member of the Khmer Rouge." We traveled to the outskirts of Phnom Penh and turned toward the killing fields. On either side of the dirt road were run-down houses. Halfway up the street was a garment factory, and dozens of women were clustered outside, sitting in the dirt, eating lunch as we passed. Impossible to recognize unless you knew the location, the killing field appeared as a ditch-strewn field, remarkably similar to the rest of the countryside we'd passed. It was far smaller than I imagined it would be, maybe 100 yards to each side. In the center, the only recognizable feature was a memorial temple to honor the dead. Over the next hour, we were led from one spot to the next. This was where 100 victims were discovered. In another spot, 200 victims were found. Over here, 400. In another spot, we learned that the skeletons unearthed had been buried without their heads, so it was impossible to know how many had been unearthed. In this particular field, we learned that thousands had died. Precise figures are impossible to know with any certainty. Micah and I simply wandered in silence, feeling sad and sickened. Eventually, we were led to the memorial temple and went inside. The temple, white in color, was 10 feet to a side and roughly 40 feet high, making it look like a rectangular block stood on end. We didn't know what to expect, but what we found left us paralyzed. running up the back wall to the top of the temple were glass-enclosed shelves, stacked with thousands and thousands of skulls. On our way back to the bus, Micah summed up my own feelings in three simple words. This was hell. In the strangest juxtaposition of the entire tour, one that left me feeling off balance for the rest of the day, we went from the killing fields straight to the Russian market for a few hours of frivolous shopping. Cambodia, like many Asian countries, has perfected the art of piracy, and the Russian market was a building crowded with hundreds of vendors, selling everything from pirated DVDs to pirated clothing. DVDs cost $3. Jeans supposedly from the Gap went for half that. The market was crowded. It seemed that every tourist visiting the country had heard about the place and had decided to visit at the same time. Despite the fact that most of our tour group had ample financial means and could afford real items back home, most everyone left the market with a bag full of bargains. On our last night in Phnom Penh, there was no cocktail party, so we were encouraged to make reservations at one of the hotel restaurants, since our hotel boasted some of the best food in Cambodia. Micah and I naturally forgot to make them and ended up eating at one of the casual dining spots in the hotel. It was nearly empty, and we finished our meal in half an hour. Although initially disappointed, we ended up being pleased by our meal. As fate would have it, everything went wrong in the kitchens that night. Everyone who'd made a reservation wound up having to wait hours for their meal. Ovens broke, cooks hadn't shown up, meals came out wrong. Murphy's Law was in full force. Appetizers took an hour and a half to reach the table. The main course followed 2 hours later. While in some circumstances that wouldn't have bothered people, we'd been on the road for 13 days. People were tired and we had to rise early for our flight to Jaipur the following morning. On a night when everyone was looking forward to getting 8 hours of sleep, as Micah and I did, most got less than five. In our room, Micah and I were watching Croc Hunter again. Along with CNN, Croc Hunter was the only English-language show we'd been able to find. Every time we'd turn on the television, no matter what country we were in, Croc Hunter was always on. By Cambodia, it had become something of a long-running joke. By our reckoning, it was the most widely watched show in the world.
"Oh, isn't this snake a beauty?"
Steve Irwin, the ever-enthusiastic Australian host, was saying.
"Look at the colors. Oh, she's magnificent, isn't she? This little beauty is dangerous. One bite can kill a dozen men."
"The guy is nuts," Micah commented. "He's always nuts," I said. "My kids love to watch him." Micah was quiet for so long I thought he'd begun to doze. When I glanced over at him, however, I saw he was staring at the ceiling. "What are you thinking about?" I asked. It was a long moment before he answered. "What we saw today, earlier this morning, the museum, the killing fields. It was awful, wasn't it?" "Yeah," he nodded. When he spoke again, his voice was subdued. "It just made me feel sad. Sad for the people here. Sad about the world. Sad about everything. And empty, too. It was all so pointless. Things like this shouldn't happen." He hesitated. "It reminded me of how I felt after Mom died." I glanced over at him, not altogether surprised at his comment. Whenever either of us were sad, our conversation always returned to the topic of our family. "Do you realize that almost everyone on this trip is older than she was when she died?" he asked. "I can't believe it's been over 13 years. It doesn't seem like it." "No, it doesn't," I agreed. "Do you realize that in less than 10 years, we'll be as old as Mom was when she died? Peyton would only be 11 years old then." I said nothing. Micah drew a long breath before going on. "And it's strange. I mean, when I think about Mom, it's like she hasn't aged. In my mind, I mean. When I think about her, I always picture the way she looked the last time I saw her. I can't even imagine what she'd look like now." He trailed off. When he spoke again, his voice was quieter. "You know what I regret?" I looked at him, waiting. "That I didn't get a chance to say goodbye. You and Kathy got to do that. When I left for Cancun, I was running late and I didn't even think to call her. And the next time I saw her, she didn't look like Mom anymore. And we were talking about donating her organs. It was just unreal. And it breaks my heart to think that after sacrificing so much for us, she never got a chance to see or hold her grandkids. She never found out that you became an author. She never got to meet Christine or the kids. Mom would have been great as a grandma." He trailed off, his gaze unfocused. "I miss her too," I said quietly. The months after my mom's funeral were halting steps in search of some sort of normalcy. No one in the family seemed to know how to react or what to do. Micah, Dana, and I tried to support one another as well as our dad. It seemed that every time one of us began crying, the others would fall in line. Thus, we each came to the independent conclusion that no one should cry anymore. And we didn't, unless we were alone. Our mom was gone, yet strangely there were times when it seemed as if she wasn't. Everything in the house bore my mother's imprint, the location of the spices in the cupboard, the placement of the photographs on the shelves, the color of the walls, her nightgown draped over the chair in her bedroom. Everywhere we looked, we were reminded of her, and there were moments when I'd be standing in the kitchen when I'd suddenly begin to feel as if my mom was standing behind me. At times like those, I would pray that I wasn't imagining it. I looked for signs, movement from the corner of my eyes, perhaps, or limbs of trees swaying in the breeze. I ached for something to let me know her spirit was still with us, but there was nothing. Yet if the house was a constant reminder of my mom, it also began to serve notice as to how empty it had come to feel. There was no energy in the house, no vivaciousness, and the sound of laughter no longer echoed off the walls. We sometimes wondered whether we should rearrange the furniture or remove more obvious signs of my mother's presence. Her purse, for instance. For years, she'd placed it in a basket near the front door. Months after her death, no one had summoned the will to put it in the closet or even open it to see what was left behind. We knew what we'd find. Pictures of the family, letters from her mother, her lipstick and personal trinkets. Those things were so personal, so mom, that we couldn't touch them for fear of somehow betraying her memory. We didn't want to forget her, and in a way, those were the only things we had left. The purse, it seemed, had become our silent entreaty for her return. That year, we didn't celebrate Christmas at the house. It was the first time in our lives we spent the holiday with other relatives, and though the company was comforting, none of us could shake the empty feeling in our hearts. Mom was gone, and Christmas at home would never be the same again. Kat and I settled into our first year of marriage while at the same time doing our best to take care of Dad. We set aside every Thursday and used that time to take my dad out to the movies or to dinner. Micah and Dana decided to rent an apartment together. It was only a couple of miles from the house, and like Kat and me, they thought it would be a good way to keep an eye on him. If the death had been hard on us kids, it had been far harder on my dad. While I can't claim to understand their relationship, my mom and dad had spent 27 years together, and his world was suddenly and completely altered now that she was gone. He seemed to live by instinct alone. After the funeral, he'd begun wearing black, and only black. At first, we thought it was a phase, but as the months passed, we began to realize how lost he was without her. He depended on my mom as we had. Because they'd been married at such a young age, my dad had no experience in being alone, or even what it was like to be an adult without her by his side. My dad lost his best friend, his lover, his confidant, and his wife. But if that wasn't hard enough, he'd also lost the only life he'd known how to live. He had to learn to cook and how to clean the house and had to do those things on his own. He lost a good portion of the family income and had to learn how to budget. And he had to learn how to relate to his kids, who for the most part had been raised by his wife. We loved our dad and he loved us, but the truth was that he seemed to know as little about us as we did about him. In our own way, we each did our best to fill the void left in his life, and one by one we slowly became replacements for all that my mother had been to him. Micah became his confidant, the only one that Dad would really talk to. My dad had always admired Micah in the same way that I had, and that feeling only grew stronger after my mother died. Micah, I think, embodied many of the things my dad always wanted to be. Handsome and charismatic, confident and popular. In a strange way, I think he began to seek my brother's approval. He took few actions without soliciting Micah's opinion, and listened to Micah's latest adventures with a proud twinkle in his eye. Kat became his buddy. He'd been fond of my wife since they'd first met, and whenever we'd stop by, they'd spend time together. They drank dessert wines and cooked together, they joked and laughed, and in sad times my dad turned to Kat when he needed a shoulder to cry on. And Kat responded by always saying or doing exactly what was needed. My dad also threw himself into taking care of my sister. He'd help her with her bills, bought her a car, took care of her health insurance. Eventually, the two of them began taking care of the horses together. My dad, it seemed, was not only doing the things he thought my mom would do as a parent, but in taking care of Dana, found the strength to go on. I, too, began to play a role my mother once had, but it was one that I would wish upon no one. With my intense schedule in high school, moving away for college, and starting a life with Kathy, I'd become the least dependent on my parents, and had been so since the age of 16. Maybe my dad realized this too, for as the weeks and months wore on, I became the outlet for my dad's anger and pain. In time, my dad began to act as if he despised me. If I asked if he needed help doing his budget, he accused me of trying to steal from him. If I cleaned up the house, he accused me of thinking he was not only helpless, but a slob. If I dropped her cocker spaniel off at the house while I worked, something Kat and I had been doing since we got her, he accused me of taking advantage of him. When Kat and I visited, there were many evenings where he refused to talk to me at all. Instead, he'd joke and laugh with my wife in the kitchen while I sat alone in the living room. This dynamic only grew worse over time. I knew he didn't hate me, that he was hurting inside, struggling even more than we kids were. I knew that his anger and pain had to go somewhere, and that deep down he loved me despite the words he said and the way he'd begun to treat me. Yet even if I understood what was going on, I nonetheless sought comfort in Kathy's arms, wondering aloud what I'd done to deserve his hostility. My brother and I did our best to continue our relationship with each other and our independent lives. Micah moved steadily forward in his real estate career, and my small business, I manufactured orthopedic wrist braces primarily for carpal tunnel syndrome, was slowly getting off the ground. Like most young people, I thought I knew far more than I actually did about running a business, and soon accumulated credit card debts that greatly exceeded our combined annual income. Despite the fact that I had been working day and night for months, it was touch and go as to whether Kat and I could meet our obligations, and we wondered how we'd ever stay afloat. In our first year of marriage, we'd been tested in every way. Kat and I were lucky that it only served to bring us closer together. In the hardest moments, when I wondered how I'd be able to pay the rent or put food on the table, I turned to Micah. He would treat me to pizza and beer, and we'd talk. In the end, we decided to sell the two rental houses we'd purchased earlier. The profit on both was enough for Kat and me to climb out of debt, and I gradually began to turn the corner in making my small company profitable. However, I still had to wait tables and my wife had to work as well, simply to make ends meet. Micah, meanwhile, continued to make life seem easy. He dated, had fun on the weekends, and excelled at his job. When Kathy and I went out in the evenings with him, we would always wonder who he'd bring along this time. Most of the women barely knew him, yet they seemed as enamored of him as I was with Kathy. Yet if he was doing well on the surface, he was struggling beneath the facade, weighed down by our dad. Dad was still having a hard time, and Micah had assumed the mantle of leadership in our family. Because Dad talked to him more than to either Dana or me, Micah alone seemed to understand the depth of my father's grief. One evening in the summer of 1990, when Micah and I were out together, I couldn't help but notice that he seemed especially preoccupied. "What's going on?" I asked. "I'm worried about Dad." Though I was worried too, I knew my reasons were different from his. With me, Dad acted irrationally. With Micah, he seemed completely rational. Neither seemed normal. "Why?" I asked. "Because he's not getting over Mom. It's been almost 9 months, but he still cries himself to sleep at night. And he's been getting edgier, too." I didn't know what to say. "And then, you know, he's still wearing black, but it's worse now. He got rid of his entire wardrobe and replaced it so that everything he owns now is black. And he never leaves the house anymore except to go to work. I know he misses Mom, but we all do. And Mom would want him to be happy, even without her. She'd want him to be strong. What do you think we should do?" "I don't know." "Do you want Kathy and me to try to talk to him?" Though I knew he wouldn't listen to me, he was becoming more dependent on my wife's company. "It won't do any good. I've tried. I've invited him over, but he never comes. And he doesn't want to go anywhere when I visit him. Does he ever go over to see you and Kat at your apartment?" "No." Micah shook his head. "He shouldn't close himself off from the world. It's only going to make it worse. It's only going to make him feel more alone." "Do you tell him that?" "All the time." "What does he say?" "He says he's doing fine." As the anniversary of my mom's death approached, my dad slowly began emerging from the self-imposed shell he'd constructed around himself. Though he still wore black, Micah, Dana, and I talked him into joining us in learning country dancing, and the evenings out seemed to revive him. Slowly but surely, he became more like his old self. Even with me, he no longer seemed nearly as bitter. Somehow, it seemed we'd survived the first year without our mother. Later that autumn, Kathy and I learned that she was pregnant, and like all anxious parents-to-be, we began making preparations for the baby while we awaited the moment we could first see our baby on the ultrasound. Kathy threw herself into the pregnancy. She watched everything she ate, exercised, and learned to live with morning sickness before she went to work. Her skin began to take on the flushed glow of an expectant mother. We called our friends and family. Everyone, including my dad, was thrilled with the news. In fact, Dad was happier than we'd seen him in a long, long time. When Kat was 12 weeks along, we visited the medical clinic for the ultrasound. In the room, I held Kat's hand as the technician applied the gel and ran the scope over my wife's belly. "There it is," the technician said quickly, and both Kathy and I stared at the screen in wonder. The image was tiny, of course, and looked nothing like a baby. A peanut, maybe, but not a baby. Still, it was our first glance, and Kathy squeezed my hand and smiled. The nurse continued to move the scope, trying to get a better picture. Within a few moments, both Kathy and I saw the technician frown. "What is it?" Kathy asked. "I'm not sure yet," the technician answered. She forced a smile. "Could you excuse me for a moment?" The technician got up and left the room. We didn't know what to make of it. We had no idea whether this was normal or unexpected. A couple of minutes later, the doctor came in. "Is anything wrong?" Kathy asked. "Let me take a look," the doctor said. For a moment, as the technician began working the scope, we watched them both staring at the screen. The technician pointed and whispered something to the doctor. He whispered something back. Neither would answer our questions. In time, the technician rose and left the room. The doctor looked serious. "Something's wrong, isn't it?" Kathy asked. "I'm sorry," he said, "but we can't find a heartbeat." Kat burst into tears. Eventually, I led her from the office. Our baby had died, just as my mother had, for no apparent reason at all. A few days later, Kat had a DNC. In the wheelchair after the procedure, all she could do was wipe her tears. There was nothing I could say to ease her pain. Later, in Micah's arms, I cried as well. Kat and I spent the next few months worrying about the possibility of becoming parents. We didn't know how long it would take for her to get pregnant again, nor did we know whether she could carry a baby to term. We'd been told that miscarriages were common. Everyone seemed to know someone who'd had one, and tried to console us with the thought that everything would be fine in the long run. We knew they meant well, we knew what they were saying was true, but we also were well acquainted with the other kind of story, the kind where things didn't work out, and to Kat, the thought of never becoming a mother was unbearable. Another hard Christmas came and went, and on my birthday, when I turned 25, my sister called to sing me happy birthday. When she asked me what I wanted, I could think of only one thing to say. Our prayers were answered again in late January 1991, but we kept the news to ourselves this time. We didn't want a repeat of what had happened before, but in April we learned the baby was developing normally and finally shared the good news. Kathy's belly grew over the summer, and she spent hours looking through baby name books and reading what to expect when you're expecting. Yet the stresses of life seemed to keep coming, one after the other, without relief. Despite working two jobs, three if you count Kat's job, we were still struggling financially, unable to get ahead. Kat had health insurance through her employer, one that covered maternity, but in early summer while she was 5 months along, she was laid off. When our Cocker Spaniel puppy reached 20 pounds, we were evicted from our apartment and had to find a new place to live. Our one car broke down completely, and the only car we could afford as a replacement was 13 years old and had 100,000 miles on the odometer. The IRS decided to audit both my business and my personal tax returns concerning the previous 3 years. Though I would eventually be cleared completely, the stress of working two jobs while collecting the necessary documents, they wanted receipts for everything, added to an already difficult summer. Somehow I was able to squeeze in time to write a book with Billy Mills entitled Joaquini. Though it would end up being the first work I'd ever publish, I was under no illusions that it had to do with the quality of my writing. Rather, its merit derived from who Billy was. In September, we rushed to the hospital when labor pains began. It was a fast labor. Kat dilated quickly and was nearly ready to deliver by the time we reached the hospital. Kat was in back labor, the baby was facing the wrong way, and in immense pain. There was a mad scramble as the room began to be readied, but moments after the doctor arrived, the baby's heart suddenly slowed. By the looks on the doctor's and nurse's faces, I knew it was serious. There was a chance we could lose another baby. All at once the world seemed to shrink. All I could think about was Kat and the baby she carried inside her. There is a panic that comes in moments like those, one that squeezes the heart with the feeling of utter helplessness. I barely remembered the heated rush of activity as the doctor swung into action. I stood off to the side, praying as I'd never prayed before. The doctor was good, and a moment later, I was a father. But the baby's skin was gray, and for the longest moment, he made no sound at all. Later, we'd learned that he was anemic, and that he'd bled back through the umbilical cord. But at the time, I simply wanted to hear the cry of life. And then, after what seemed like forever, I finally did. Within a few minutes, minutes that seem far longer when it's actually happening, the doctor assured us our son would be fine, and for the first time I relaxed enough to realize we'd actually become parents. Kat held the baby against her. We named him Miles Andrew, and the first person I called was Micah.
"I'm a father," I screamed into the receiver. "I have a son."
Micah whooped on the other end.
"Congratulations, Daddy. How's Mama doing?"
"She's doing great, and thankfully the baby is too. But you've got to get down here. You've got to see this little guy. He's so cute." He laughed again.
"I'm on my way, little brother. I'm on my way."
He was the first one to reach the hospital, and after taking one look at Miles, he turned to me.
"Why, he looks just like me."
I slapped him on the back.
"You should only be so lucky. You might be handsome, but you don't hold a candle to this guy."
Despite the new life of fatherhood I was suddenly leading, my brother and I continued to make time to be together. For a short while, he helped me with my orthopedic business, but by the end of the year, I eventually decided to give it up. With a new child at home, I needed something more stable, and I took a job as a pharmaceutical representative with Letterly Labs in 1992. It was the first time in my life in which I'd officially be earning above minimum wage. I was 26 years old. But if the baby and my radically transformed life was enough to help me keep from dwelling on my mom, my dad continued to experience intense periods of ups and downs. The good mood he'd had over the summer was replaced with a funk, then replaced again with optimism. It had reached the point where we didn't know what to expect when we went to see him, and both Micah and I wondered aloud whether he was manic depressive. My sister, too, seemed to be having a rough time, struggling to find herself as many young adults do. Never a great student, she dropped out of college to work full-time, then proceeded to quit her job a couple of weeks later. From there, she wandered from one job to the next, working as a cocktail waitress, an aerobics instructor, a receptionist at a tanning salon. She and Micah got separate apartments again, and my dad helped her with the rent. Physically, she was changing as well. By her early 20s, she'd become something of a beauty. She was quite popular with the opposite sex all of a sudden. But like Micah, she seemed to move quickly from one relationship to the next. "What is it with you two?" I asked Micah one night.
"What do you mean?"
"You and Dana. Can't either of you date anyone for longer than a month?"
"I dated Julie and Cindy for years."
"Half the time you say you were dating them, you were actually broken up, and you were dating other people. And then you ended it with both of them." He smiled. "Not everyone wants to be married at 23, Nick." "I didn't plan to marry that early. It's just that I met Kathy."
"You didn't have to marry her right away."
"Yes, I did. Do you know what she said to me when she decided to move to California, while I was picking her up at the airport?" He shook his head. "When I met her at the airport, I started telling her all this really sweet stuff. You know, how much I loved her, how glad I was that she'd moved out here, how much I appreciated her courage. Anyway, she let me finish before she finally smiled. I love you too, Nick, and I'm glad I came. But let's get one thing straight. As much as I love you, I'm not going to abandon my family for a relationship that might be only temporary." "So what does that mean?" I asked her, and she patted my chest. "You've got 6 months to propose, or I'm going back home." Micah's eyes widened.
"She said that?"
"Yep." He laughed.
"I love that girl. She doesn't take guff from anyone, does she?"
"Nope."
"You did the right thing, Nick. You couldn't have married anyone better."
"I know. But as I was saying earlier, what's with you?"
"It's simple, Nick," he said. "I haven't met my Kathy yet. But when I do, I'll marry her and settle down."
By 1992, 3 years after my mom had died, each of us had somehow found a way to move on. I had a family and a new career. Dana had a new boyfriend and was back in college. Micah continued to date and enjoy one exciting weekend after the next. Though Dad was still wearing black, the ups and downs were getting less frequent, and he'd even begun to think about dating again. Our family life, as much as could be expected,
was gradually regaining some semblance of normalcy. In October, Kathy and I eventually came to the conclusion that it would be best if we moved away. While we loved California, practicalities precluded us from being able to create the kind of family life we wanted for our son. My salary, while decent, wasn't enough to enable us to live in the kind of neighborhood Kathy wanted for miles. Nor, due to the rapidly escalating housing costs, could we foresee a change in the future. What Kat and I wanted